This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll discuss the extraordinary victory giving people rights who are now in Bagram prison in Afghanistan.
Finally, the right that Guantanamo prisoners were given to challenge their detention has been extended to prisoners at Bagram. We'll talk to Tina Foster, the lawyer who brought that case for clients she never met.
When Obama took office, he said he would close Guantanamo in a year. Has anything changed?
We talk with Emmy McLean at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who will tell us whether or not things have changed at Guantanamo, whether anyone has been released, and what positions the Obama administration has taken in court. Is it change we can believe in? Stay with us.
Michael Ratner, welcome back from Europe. It's nice to see you. You were at the 60th anniversary of the formation of NATO, which also was the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And there was a lot of action when you were over there. Tell me, what's happening?
Well, you know, I didn't go to Europe because I'm in love with NATO or because I thought it was important to signify the 60th anniversary of its violations of human rights over the last years and its renewed expansion again and again into the borders, over the borders it used to have, and of course now fighting in Afghanistan. We were there to put on a conference called 6060, which, as you said, Michael, is the 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights, along with the 60th anniversary of NATO. And we were trying to contrast what NATO is with its obligations under the Declaration of Human Rights. And in fact, if you look at the NATO Charter, it actually says it should be complying with human rights. It says it's based on the UN Charter, which, of course, is very heavily involved in trying to talk about human rights. And so the one-day conference in Strasbourg, which is in France, and I'd never been there before, but the one-day conference in Strasbourg was the day before the NATO conference began and the day before protesters, as people saw in the media, tried to burn down one of the hotels, as well as cross the bridge. Strasbourg is on the border between Germany and France, and there's a bridge called, I think it's called the Peace Bridge or something like that. And, of course, the cops wouldn't let the protesters on one side cross to the other side and were incredibly brutal throughout the period in Strasbourg. So it was a pretty interesting moment. And, of course, the efforts of NATO is really becoming it's essentially a U.S.-based alliance that's a war alliance, and that's the only way to look at it.
NATO was ostensibly formed. It was, in my opinion, formed to protect capitalism in Europe, but is ostensibly formed to prevent what they called Russian expansion. The existence of NATO after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, it's got no reason to exist except for what you just said.
Well, one of the themes that came out of the conference that I was at was NATO's role today. And you look at it almost, I don't know if people remember when there were a series of frontline states in southern Africa against apartheid, which were very positive use of those frontline states to try and fight apartheid. This is a negative use of NATO, and it's still about Russian expansion. It's still about saying NATO is expanding and adding more and more countries all the time, particularly along its eastern front. And those countries are ones that, if you look at a sort of L shape going from the Baltics down across into Iran and through Central Asia, actually, those are states that the U.S. is trying to either get involved with, get them into NATO, or use as military bases as essentially an L-shaped eastern front line against expansion of the Soviet Union, but really not expansion of the Soviet Union, U.S. control of resources in that area, particularly the oil-rich area of Central Asia. And so that's what NATO's role really is right now. It's still to protect, essentially, as you said, Western Europe, the U.S., and ensure that we have the resources and take them away from the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Following up on their great victory in dismantling socialist Yugoslavia.
That's right. The other interesting thing about the conference was not only about NATO expansion and its use of as a buffer, or more as a buffer than takeover of Central Asia and Eastern Europe, was the issue of NATO's role in the U.S. rendition program. And this was really contentious. The rendition program, as we all know, is where the U.S. picked up people all over the world, flew them and landed at Europe's airports, even set up secret sites in Europe, in Poland and Romania. And the question was that simply done on the basis of the U.S. having bilateral agreements with all these countries to use their airports, to use their facilities for secret sites, et cetera, or was it somehow done in a NATO framework? And that was probably the most interesting discussion, because we had someone there, a person named Gavin Simpson, who'd actually written a report called the Marty Report. The Marty Report is a Council of Europe report by a Swiss representative named Dick Marty, and that's the one that outlined all of the rendition program. And in that report, it was said that the mechanics or the framework for the rendition program was set up by NATO, and that individual countries were then hammered with it by the United States, which said, well, you see, NATO gave us a mandate, and therefore you have to let us use your airports for this rendition, and this rendition, which is extraordinary rendition, torture. And that was heavily debated because someone from NATO actually showed up, a former NATO official who was second in command at NATO, who was completely familiar with what NATO had done. And that argument was very, very intense. He said, yes, there's broad authority. It says that the United States can use European ports, airports, et cetera, for carrying out its self-defense, because this is the first time NATO ever invoked what's called Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, which implied that attack on one NATO country is an attack on all, and basically all the NATO countries had to cooperate with the United States. But his position was, yes, there was a broad mandate, but it was not contemplated that it would be used for extraordinary rendition or the use of torture by sending people from one place to another. Gavin Simpson, on the other hand, said he wasn't really saying that it actually spelled out rendition, but it gave the broad authority to use ports. And then the U.S. came along and would go to countries and say, see, we've gotten this NATO mandate. You have to let us land these people at your airports, and you have to give us secret sites, et cetera. So we never really resolved it. My takeaway from it was that the mandate was made so broad by NATO that they actually knew that it would be misused. It was made to be misused and made to be one in which the U.S. could carry out all kinds of functions and in which it could actually hammer European countries to say, we want the authority to land and to render people all over Europe.
Switching from the NATO part of it, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is now 60 years old, a little younger than us. Sum up the discussion on that, please.
Well, the discussion on that was really similar to what I'm saying. I mean, the Universal Declaration prohibits torture, sets forth really the fundamental human rights framework that we all live by, which is fair trials for people, no kidnapping, no torture, and also, of course, has a set of economic rights in there, which, of course, the U.S. is the bastion of violation of fundamental economic rights. And those were compared to what NATO has done, and one of them was this extraordinary rendition program. The second one, though, is what the U.S. has done through NATO, really, or on its own, which is to hold people at places like Guantanamo and other secret sites around the world, disappearing them, not giving them fair trials, and holding them under preventive detention. So we're really contrasting what NATO does with the Universal Declaration's requirements, and to put it mildly, NATO came up quite short. It was a good start, and then, of course, afterwards, Michael, we did one of your favorite things.
Tell us about it.
We drove 2 hours north out of Strasbourg, staying on the French side, because the German side was essentially shut down, and you couldn't get past roadblocks and cops that were everywhere. And we went to a town called Trier, T-R-I-E-R, which is in Germany, and is the birthplace of Karl Marx.
And his wife.
And his wife, right. So that was very, very exciting. We went into the house of Karl Marx. It's actually owned by the Social Democrats now, which are the Social Democratic Party of Germany. And they've embraced Karl Marx, hard as that is to believe. But of course, the Social Democrats would be considered the left wing in the United States because they actually believe in health care and education and pensions and those kinds and unemployment insurance. So they're Social Democrats, but they've embraced Marx. They gave you Marx's history all through when you walk through the house with these special earphones. You'll hear the Internationale played in German. It was actually quite moving and exciting. They showed a picture of Karl Marx's house during the Nazi occupation or the Nazi rule. And, of course, the Nazis had purposely put Nazi flags in front of the house and taken it over. And, you know, I guess it was one of the houses of the what they call a decadent art, but decadent politics. And then the final room at the very top actually was interesting. It had murals of the revolutions that we're all familiar with, and the ones that succeeded and didn't. The Maoist Revolution, the Soviet Revolution, the Cuban Revolution.
The German Revolution of 1848 that Marx helped
German,
lead.
That was all over the place. Yeah. That was actually very important. This was more contemporary in the top room. The 1848 was another room. This was in a top room. And it also had pictures of Lumumba, who, if people will recall, was in a CIA plot to get rid of him with the Belgians when he was in the Congo. And they did. And then you put on the earphones, and what it said was you thought it was going to say, oh, these are all terrible. This is how awful what's happened. And instead it said, yes, sometimes Marx was misinterpreted, and people did things in his name they shouldn't have done. But we have to understand, and remember, this is from the Social Democrats, we have to understand what capitalism has done and is doing to the world. It is increasing unemployment dramatically. Capitalism is responsible for that. And it went on in that vein. And here's the Social Democrats then saying, we have to read and understand Marx, and they embraced Marx. So when you go there, it's a pretty big eye-opener compared to how we live in this country.
That's really extraordinary. You know, Marx's great work, Capital, is now a bestseller in East Germany.
I didn't know that, actually. Yeah. And I, of course, bought my kids, you know, red Marx mugs, as well as the original reprint of the Communist Manifesto. They were completely thrilled to get.
I want to say that that's a document from 1848 that's well worth reading today, particularly for its long view of history. I was lecturing once at Swarthmore College. A kid in the back raised his hand and asked me for recommendations on what he should read. If you haven't read Malcolm X's speeches, you should really read them all. And you should also read the Communist Manifesto. And when I said that, two professors got up and walked out.
Again, I always do two things. One, there were quotes by Marx, of course, on the walls all over the house. And one of them was the famous quote that I love that you and I always talk about, which I'm going to let you tell what it is. It's the one about philosophers and what they do. But wait, don't tell it yet. Because then, after I went to Marx's house from Trier, I eventually drove to Dusseldorf and then took a train into Berlin, where I had a series of meetings, but I also had some lectures at what's called Humboldt University, which is in East Germany, but has the most Nobel Prize winners, I think, of any university in the world. And I went into Humboldt, and again, you go into Humboldt, and you come in the opening grand entrance, and there's a huge marble wall in front of you, and there's a bust of Karl Marx. Engraved into the marble is, again, in German, the most famous quote that I love from Marx. It's not, there's a specter haunting Europe. That's not it. What is it, Michael?
Well, I can say it in English. And it's, heretofore, philosophers have merely interpreted the world. The point is to change it.
Said what in whatever year it was. I think it was it was notes that he was making on Feuerbach, I think, where they got it from.
That's
and what's
right.
Interesting, even though now Germany is united and this is still up there in social democratic Germany, it was put up there in 1953, according to a plaque right next to it. And then I guess the West Germans or the Social Democrats had to figure out, are we going to leave this up here, this Karl Marx quote? Are we going to chisel it off the wall? As people remember, like Rockefeller chiseled off
Diego Rivera's mural.
Diego Rivera's mural at Rockefeller Center when it had a picture of Marx in it.
Lenin. Yeah.
So I guess the Germans had to decide when they took after reunification, are they going to leave it up or not? So they put up a plaque that explains why they left it up.
You know, the same thing happened at the university in Budapest, the great university in the capital of Hungary. And I walked into the economics department, and there was a huge bust of Marx in the hallway of the economics department. Europe is a bit different than the United States.
Well, the plaque tries to say, look, this was put up in 53. It's really part of the university. It has now been landmarked. So you actually can't get rid of it. That's nice. But it is, I mean, honestly, in the end, whatever we think, you know, there's many problems in Europe, obviously, particularly around Muslim immigrants and immigration in general, whether it's surrounding Paris or Spain. They're way, way advanced in certain areas compared to this country, just way advanced. And those are really the economic indicators of healthcare, education, housing.
The communists and the
pensions.
Socialists in Europe helped fight against the Nazis during World War II, and they emerged as heroes of the resistance. And the labor movement and the socialist movement was never broken in Europe the way it was broken in this country starting in 1947. And I think that's the bottom line between them and us.
Well, that's what you see. Even in France in these recent economic times, you see there's a whole tradition of taking the head of the company hostage. And it's been written about a lot, and they keep him for a couple of days. There's actually a set of informal rules. They don't get arrested. They take the heads of the company hostage when there's layoffs, and they start negotiating from that point. So enough on that. It's always a pretty remarkable trip to Europe, but you really feel like when you come back here that despite our sort of vibrancy and frontier mentality and openness, supposedly, that we're a backwards nation.
Michael, there have been some remarkable developments coming out of Spain with respect to the torture that the United States engaged in that was legally justified, which the Spaniards are now getting involved in. Bring us up to date on that.
You know, we talk about torture a lot on this program. We talk particularly about, in current times, the failure of the Obama administration to really stop it completely, but even more so to have anybody held accountable for it. And the Spanish prosecution and a number of other things that are going on are really, in some way, they're driving a stake through the heart of torture in this country, and in some way a stake through the torture conspirators, through the hearts of the torture conspirators. And it's serious stuff that's going on right now, and it's making the Obama administration look like they're just diddling around with this stuff, if not worse, covering it up and preventing it. And the first big, really, if you're going to talk about anything, I guess it's the Spanish prosecution.
Yeah.
A few days before I went to Europe, the Spanish investigating judge, Judge Garzón, who I'm sure we all recall was the investigating judge who actually indicted Pinochet, got him arrested in England on an international, or at least an arrest warrant in England, and eventually forced, really, the Chileans to begin a prosecution of Pinochet, is the investigating judge in the case that has currently been filed in Spain. And the Spanish case was filed by four Spanish lawyers, extremely interesting. Garzón's the judge, and it's against six of the lawyers who were involved in really setting up, as the complaint says, setting up the framework for fraudulently hiding torture or protecting torturers. A fraudulent framework is what they call it. And the six are some of the well-known figures. There's Gonzalez, who was both the president's counsel as well as attorney general. Addington, who's Cheney's counsel. Two guys who are well-known from the Office of Legal Counsel, currently a sitting federal circuit judge, Judge Bybee, and then John Yoo, of course, of infamous Yoo memo fame. And then you have two people from Department of Defense, Haynes and Feith. These six lawyers may well soon be indicted. This is really the opening of an investigation, but may well be indicted and international arrest warrants issued. And what's fascinating about the Spanish case, so while it is what we call a universal jurisdiction case, which is to say that torture anywhere in the world can be looked at, investigated, and the torturers brought to justice.
It's even heavier than that.
But it is heavier than that, even because this is a particular aspect of universal jurisdiction or of even jurisdiction in general. Five of the people who were tortured at Guantanamo are either Spanish citizens or Spanish residents. And what that means, it's as if a U.S. citizen gets murdered overseas. The U.S. has jurisdiction to investigate that murder in certain cases. And it really is an extra special jurisdictional hook for the Spanish. It's going to make this case very hard to dismiss because Spanish citizens, Spanish residents were tortured at Guantanamo. We have a legal word for it. It's called passive personality. But it's a basis for jurisdiction. So this case is most likely going to really move forward. There's going to be politics played out in Spain, you know, obviously with people trying to get rid of it, people trying to go after Garzón, the higher court trying to say, don't do this. But my guess is this case is going to go forward. And it has two implications that are really important. One implication is I think it puts huge pressure on the Obama administration to begin a serious criminal investigation. Because the only way, and it's not guaranteed, but the only way to begin to undercut European prosecutions or say to the European prosecutor, don't go forward, is if the U.S., which has primary jurisdiction in most cases, it's the main place where the torture conspirators live, work, carried out their policy. If the U.S. does a serious investigation, the Spanish could conceivably, although they're not legally required because they were Spanish citizens, the Spanish could conceivably hold off on the investigation. So there's huge pressure on the U.S. Now, why would the U.S. care at all about this? I mean, I couldn't believe the Times article I read said, well, mostly symbolic is this investigation. And, you know, that's dead wrong. And as I wrote in a response, I said, well, ask Pinochet if he felt that the Spanish investigation and indictment was symbolic when he was putting in months under house arrest in England. But ask the people who were the six potential defendants,
These are the six top lawyers in the United States in terms of government lawyers that designed the torture policy and rationalized it, calling it wasn't torture or that you can do this, you can do that. They rationalized torture. The six top lawyers in the United States. Explain how that plays out in terms of Obama administration politics.
Well, just ask. I mean, you're sitting there and you're Haynes. Haynes was the Department of Defense lawyer who approved the so-called Rumsfeld techniques that were used in Guantanamo, or was in the chain of approval on those. And Haynes is currently the general counsel, I think, for Chevron, the big oil company.
It took him a while to get a new job, but he landed right.
it. Not a bad job, I presume, for him. But I'm just wondering, does that job require a little bit of international travel? Does he have to go to Europe for Chevron? Does he have to go anywhere in the world? And, you know, as we speak, it's conceivable there's already been arrest warrants issued for these six guys. Yeah. I'm not sure of that. It may even be unlikely this early. But once those arrest warrants are issued, 25 countries, including Spain, under the European Union's conventions and treaties, are required, more or less depending on their domestic laws, to enforce those arrest warrants. That means, how is Chevron's attorney, Haynes, going to travel in Europe anywhere? I don't see how he keeps his job or doesn't really consider it extremely serious. Take a second guy. Take John Yoo. John Yoo, we know, leaves Berkeley on occasion and likes to lecture in Italy. Well, John Yoo is not going to be lecturing in Italy right now. If there's an arrest warrant, or even if there's not one, he must be very scared of that. Take a federal judge, Bybee, a federal circuit judge, very high. Is Obama really going to sit by and watch while a federal judge, whatever he did, can't travel anywhere in the world, essentially, but certainly there are 25 countries in Europe? So I think that's going to cause increased pressure on the Obama administration. Even if they said, okay, we don't want to look at this, they're going to have to do something, because they're going to start, I mean, Chevron is not like a nothing company to start complaining.
No, Chevron was a major branch of Standard Oil before they divided it off. But Michael, how does this play out with respect to Obama and the Republicans? Obama's got several attorneys that he wants to appoint to high positions in administrations. And the Republicans are blackmailing him on this. Talk about that.
We do understand that. There's two people, Dawn Johnson and Harold Coe, that names have been mentioned in the paper. Dawn Johnson is a law professor, supposed to become the head of Office of Legal Counsel. I think she's had her hearing. She got through the committee. Very good person, liberal. Was at least, I think, the one time the head of, or at least involved with very pro-abortion groups. And I think that's what's hanging her up as well. And Harold Coe, of course, the dean at Yale Law School. Both of these people have written extensively against the Bush administration.
They want him to be the attorney for the State Department.
Right. Harold, they want to be the State Department legal counsel. And both of them have written extensively on the torture programs of Obama. Both have spoken out on these issues. Yale, actually, although not Harold, not necessarily involved, represents some Guantanamo detainees, one of the clinics does. And they should sail through. I mean, these guys are the top of their – both Dawn and Harold are the top of the line people, and they'd be very good in these positions, particularly when, you know, you consider the really bad guys who were in the OLC before. Scott Horton, the writer for Harper's occasionally, said in one of his articles that they were going to consider filibustering, whether one or both of the nominees, if the Obama administration released three key memos. And those memos were approved for release. These are torture memos. They were approved for release by both Greg Craig, who's Obama's counsel, and Eric Holder.
Yeah.
The Attorney General of the United States.
Yeah,
so that we should
yeah.
have seen him already, Michael.
Sure,
we
sure.
should have announced him on the show.
Sure.
But they haven't come out yet. And the answer is, why haven't they come out? Well, the CIA was going crazy. In fact, the guy, he's John Brennan, I think is his name. He was the second or third at the CIA under Bush. He now, I think, has an appointment with Obama in the National Security Council. And he couldn't get the CIA appointment because he was under Obama, because he was so allegedly involved in the torture, waterboarding and all of that. So the CIA is opposing the release of these memos, but apparently I guess they weren't being listened to, and maybe the Obama administration still wanted to release them, and now the Republicans are threatening a filibuster of these two appointments. We'll see what happens. I don't know what's going to happen. What the question is, will there be a cave-in and say, look, okay, we won't release the memos, approve our two appointees, or will Obama do what I think he should do, was say, go ahead. You guys try and filibuster these guys, and you're going to look ridiculous. And we'll try and get through it, and we're just going to show you that you're nothing but a bunch of people trying to protect the torturers. But I don't know what's going to happen.
I don't know either, but I have to say that I'd be surprised if the Obama administration does the right thing here.
You know, Michael, it's unfortunate, but I would be surprised as well, because so far they have failed to do the right thing on almost every one of these issues, whether it's with Spain or whether it's with now these current memos, or whether it's taking state secrets privilege all over the lot, from torture to wiretapping. So far, they haven't stood up for what we need. And what that really drives home, the point that you and I consistently make here, we should not look to Obama. We have to look to ourselves. And the answer is we have to just hold this government's feet to the fire like we did the last one and say this cannot be a country of torture, cannot be a country of wiretapping, and there has to be accountability.
Absolutely.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last week, in an incredibly important and significant ruling, a federal judge held that some prisoners at the U.S. military base at Bagram have a right to go into court and challenge their detentions. It's the first case in which prisoners held in the so-called U.S. War on Terror, or whatever Obama calls it now, have actually been given the right to go into a court. It's also significant that the Obama administration, like the Bush administration, opposed the right of these four detainees to test their detention in court. The lawyer for the four, Tina Foster, a former Center for Constitutional Rights attorney who has been working on this case for many years and now is the executive director of the International Justice Network, was ecstatic about the ruling and said that this extends Guantanamo, the ruling at Guantanamo, the favorable ruling, quote, to any place where the United States seeks to hold individuals in a legal black hole. We're excited today to talk to Tina Foster, who has done a remarkable job in representing Bagram detainees who she has never yet met. Tina, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Tina, you know, I was in Germany when I read a quick, on our listserv that we both belong to, the Guantanamo listserv, about your amazing victory at Bagram. And I think our listeners know very little about this subject. So why don't you start with saying, what's Bagram? Is it the same as Guantanamo? Who's in there? And what did you win?
Sure. Well, Bagram, actually, most people don't know this, but Bagram was actually the first U.S. military prison where many of the detainees that eventually ended up at Guantanamo were held. It's in Afghanistan, about an hour outside of Kabul, and it's the main military base, air base in Afghanistan, and it was an old Soviet air hangar where they've established a prison. And what we saw after September 11th with the Bush administration picking up people from all over the world and pulling them into the American gulag, the very first stop for many of them was Afghanistan. And a lot of those folks ended up eventually at Bagram. There's about 600 there now, but a good portion of them eventually got moved on to Guantanamo and, you know, the rest of the history of what happened there.
Bagram is run by the United States government?
There's no dispute that it is 100% under the jurisdiction and control of the U.S. government, the U.S. military airbase, and there's other forces, coalition forces that are present in Afghanistan that have some sort of a military presence, but they're sort of as guests of the United States on the airbase. So the prison itself is totally run by the U.S., and that was part of the basis of our case, that there isn't any other law that applies. There is no other sovereign that has any control over the prisoners at Bagram.
Now, how many people are in Bagram right now?
About 600, according to U.S. government releases. Of course, they don't tell us the exact numbers. It's very similar to the situation that you and many of us were in Guantanamo back in 2004 before the Supreme Court ruled that the Guantanamo detainees had a right to challenge their detention. We had no idea who was at Guantanamo, and we're in the same situation now with Bagram because the government hasn't released the names or even the numbers of people that it's holding there officially.
We're speaking with Tina Foster, who's the executive director of the International Justice Network and a very fine international lawyer. Tina, what did the government argue in resisting your kind of common sense position that people have a right to confront their accusers and sort out their situation and get out of there if they're innocent? What did the government say in response to that?
Well, I mean, the government says in response to that that unlike Guantanamo, Bagram is in the middle of a war zone in Afghanistan. Now, in the cases of our four clients who were the subject of the Bates decision that came down last week, it made very little sense for them to argue that because all four of those individuals were captured outside of Afghanistan, had nothing to do with the conflict in Afghanistan, but were brought from as far away as Thailand, for one example, and brought into Bagram by the United States against their will.
That's so amazing, Tina. Those people could have often been taken to Guantanamo, I guess, but since you have legal rights to go to Guantanamo, they maybe wanted to take them somewhere else, I guess.
Yeah, I think that since the great victories at Guantanamo of lawyers being able to go down to the base and represent clients there, you know, it became a much less attractive option for holding people outside of public and legal scrutiny. So, you know, Bagram became a nice alternative. So that one theory is that when Guantanamo got all of the scrutiny, that Bagram became the replacement for it. I think probably even a more accurate assessment might be that Bagram was sort of the original Guantanamo in that a lot of the people, as I said, that ended up at Guantanamo first spent some time at Bagram, even in the early days before Guantanamo got that scrutiny. So I think originally it might have been a sorting point for people that went on to Guantanamo, but at this point, Guantanamo is not an option in terms of sending people to another secret prison.
How did you ever wind up representing anybody if you can't go into the prison?
Interestingly, back in the day, several years ago, you know, when I was working with you, Michael, at the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of the happy tasks I had was to travel all over the world and try to find the family members of the detainees at Guantanamo. And during that time, it became clear that there were a lot of folks that were in other places besides Guantanamo, and those people asked the question, well, if the United States government is holding my brother at Bagram instead of Guantanamo, what difference does that make to me? I still have no legal recourse. You know, I didn't really have a very good answer to that question. And so looking into it and looking into, you know, the sort of legal position of Bagram, it looks very much like Guantanamo. There's a lease agreement, et cetera. So it became the forgotten prison in a lot of people's minds, and that's why we decided to focus there, because there was already a lot of attention on Guantanamo.
Do you know anything about the conditions that people have lived under over the last years in Bagram? Is it similar to Guantanamo? Was there sort of a Rumsfeld-like abuse and torture program going on?
Well, the same folks that were responsible for the horrible abuses and torture that happened at Abu Ghraib, those folks were also in charge of Bagram for a period of time. And during that time, detainees actually died in custody from torture and interrogation. There's the film The Taxi to the Dark Side, which talks about the deaths of a couple of Afghan detainees who were at Bagram. More recently, we haven't seen as egregious stories of people being tortured to death, but the conditions are unbelievably brutal for many of the people. Some of our clients that have been released from Bagram have reported the same type of sleep deprivation, exposure to temperatures. In Afghanistan, in the winter, you know, there's snow on the ground. It's very, very cold. And if you leave somebody outside, that's the same as turning on the air conditioning to an unbearable point. And some of our clients actually had frostbite and other sort of complications from having been left outside in the cold as part of breaking for their interrogations.
What has been the response of the Obama administration to Bagram?
Shockingly, the Obama administration wholeheartedly has adopted the Bush administration policy on Bagram. All of their legal arguments, all of the secrecy, still has not decided to disclose any information. The only thing that the Obama administration has done is say that on the same day when Obama signed the executive orders closing Guantanamo, set up a task force to look at detainee policy more broadly, and that report is due in July. But I think given what we've seen over the past several months from DOJ lawyers in the Bagram cases, I don't think you're going to see much of a sea change with respect to detainee policy in a meaningful way.
I want to go back to the decision again. What you did was you filed, as you worked on with Guantanamo, a writ of habeas corpus for your four clients, which means the right to go to court and challenge their detention. As you said, the Obama administration, first the Bush administration, then the Obama administration, really took a very similar position, which is they have absolutely no legal rights at Guantanamo for habeas corpus. And then you won. And in a 55-page decision by Judge Bates, apparently, just a week or so ago, what was the key part of Judge Bates' decision?
The crux of Judge Bates' decision was that the fact that there is no other process and there's no other place that these particular individuals can go, and that the United States has ultimate control over their fates, provides a sufficient basis for them to be able to challenge their detention in U.S. courts under the Boumediene factor. So I think that it stands for the proposition that the United States government cannot manipulate the jurisdiction of the courts by holding people deliberately in places where the courts traditionally have not exercised jurisdiction. So I think it's significant in that it provides a limit on the executive's ability to act lawlessly without any sort of judicial check.
Tina, if people want more information about the Bagram cases, is there a place they can go?
Yes, they should visit the International Justice Network website. It's www.ijnetwork.org, and you can learn more about the decisions there.
So it's ijnetwork.org, ijnetwork.org. Now I have a couple of last questions, Tina. One is, if this had been the ultimate victory, the final victory, and there's no appeal, what would happen?
Well, I think the next step would be very similar to what the Guantanamo detainees have been having as a process in being able to challenge their detentions in habeas proceedings. So it doesn't mean, you know, necessarily that our clients would be released, but it means that we would have an opportunity to examine the charges or the allegations against them and to have our clients rebut those. And we don't think the U.S. government has anything. The reason that they've been there so long is simply a matter of inertia. There's been nobody pushing the government to say what they have on our clients. So I think if the government didn't appeal the decision and didn't dig in its heels, I think the result might be for our innocent clients would be released. But, you know, in terms of a process, it would look something like what the Guantanamo detainees have been getting in the D.C. District Court.
So this would be ideal in some ways, but of course, what's going to happen right now is I presume the government is going to appeal, and during that appeal, I presume they're going to ask that you don't get to visit your clients.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hold out some hope that the government might not appeal this case, only that seems like a lot of time and effort and resources for this administration to put into defending a Bush administration policy that they've disavowed already with Guantanamo, and the ruling is only affecting a very small portion of the individuals at Bagram. And so I think it's a pretty good litmus test, but it is possible that they could do the right thing and decide that this is just completely irrational to appeal this decision. But we've been disappointed before.
Tina, that's what makes you a great lawyer, is you always think you're going to win.
All good lawyers have to be optimistic, Michael.
Right,
we've been talking with Tina Foster, who is the executive director of the International Justice Network. Congratulations.
Yeah, I want to just say the same thing, Tina. You've been at this for years, and it's a well-deserved victory by a lawyer who I know fights extremely hard for a client. So congratulations, Tina.
Thanks, guys.
2 days after Obama became president, he issued an executive order saying Guantanamo ought to be closed in 1 year. However, the way in which it was to be closed was not specified in the order. Today we're going to talk to Emmy McLean, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who will give us an update as to how the Obama administration is doing in closing Guantanamo. It'll go from what's happening in the habeas cases down in the district court in Washington to the Uyghurs who have been sitting in Guantanamo for 7 years already, completely innocent, to what's happening in the appeals courts and beyond, as well as in Guantanamo. Has there been change we can believe in? Emmy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emmy, I don't want to prejudge the questions, but Obama on January 22nd signed an order saying, let's close Guantanamo within 1 year. And I'm interested in really an update overall of how we're doing on that, what's happening on that, and is there really change we can believe in?
I have to say, unfortunately, we've seen very little change, either in both in legal positions and in practicalities. There has been one person who's left Guantanamo in the nearly 3 months of Obama's term in office. That's fewer people than have left Guantanamo in the months prior to his inauguration. More people left in the last weeks of the Bush administration than have left in the early weeks of the Obama administration.
Let's look at that for a second, Emmy, because right now, and I, you know the numbers better than I do, but there's at least 17 Uyghurs who a court and even the Obama administration and the Bush administration have said shouldn't be there. There's some 60 or 70, I think, who at least our numbers so show shouldn't be there. There's a number of people that the federal courts say shouldn't be there. I mean, can you give us a sense of the numbers and what should happen?
Yeah, there's about 240 people who are at Guantanamo now. By our best estimate, I think approximately 20 of those people will face any kind of prosecution, which should be devastating numbers when you look at what the system is. We've held over 775 people at Guantanamo, and at the end of the day, after 8 years of the continuation of this regime, only about 20 of those men are going to be prosecuted. The people who remain in Guantanamo today in 2009 are not there because of some greater threat assessment, contrary to Dick Cheney's assertions. They're there because of their country of nationality, first and foremost. Almost all of the Europeans were released early on. Almost all of the Yemenis remain behind. So the people who are in Guantanamo today are in large part Yemenis. 100 of the 240 are Yemeni, effectively refugees. About 60 men who can't be returned to their home countries because they would face torture or persecution, and assorted other individuals from countries where diplomatic barriers prevented their repatriation, like our Somali refugee client, who we're trying to get back to Somaliland, a country that is an independent republic that has no diplomatic relations with the United States. I just think that that's a travesty when you look at the history of Guantanamo. The people who we're holding are the people we're holding because they don't have somewhere to go or because the U.S. won't transfer them, not for any other reason.
Why can't they come here?
Well, that's a very good question and a big question that has now been raised to the Supreme Court. With regard to the Uyghurs that Michael had mentioned earlier, there are 17 men who the U.S. has long acknowledged are improperly detained, not enemy combatants, should have been released long ago, a Muslim minority from China, the Uyghurs. A federal district judge ordered in October of last year that they be released into the United States. The Bush administration challenged that release, and while we asked for the Obama administration to drop that challenge, he has thus far refused to do so. And we have now raised an appeal to the Supreme Court asking them to review that case and to order their release into the United States. Habeas corpus means nothing if there is no remedy attached to it.
When I look at examples that really make me probably incredibly angry at the current state of affairs, it is the case you bring up, Emmy. It's the Uyghurs. 7 years, and Obama, with the stroke of a pen, could say, bring those 17 into the United States. Here we fight like heck when a person spends one extra day in prison at an arraignment or anything else. And look what we're finding here. I mean, I just find it, I don't know what to say. It's really unspeakable, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's unspeakable, and also the remaining men who were there. I mean, I was in Guantanamo on Inauguration Day, actually, and had the honor and displeasure of going back after hearing the inauguration during the lunch when we couldn't be in the jail interviewing and speaking with our clients, going back to this Somali client and telling him what came out of the inauguration. And I came back 2 days later and saw many in the civil liberties and human rights community celebrating an executive order that announced the closure of Guantanamo in 1 year. But nothing has really changed in reality for the men that are in prison there today. And the only way that I think we can allow ourselves to celebrate 1 year more of indefinite detention on an executive order for men who have been already imprisoned without charge for over 7 years is because of the consistent devaluation of the life and the liberty of the men in prison there. So the Uyghurs are one example. There are also Yemenis who are there who have been told that they could be released years ago, but the U.S. says we don't trust Yemen, so we're not going to release them to Yemen. We have a Libyan client that has actually fought hard to prevent his transfer to Libya. So instead, he's stuck in Guantanamo, fighting essentially to stay in Guantanamo because he doesn't have anywhere to go. That's what we've created at Guantanamo.
Yeah, no, Emmy, each case, you know, I was with another one of your counsel in Europe with Pardis, and we were talking about the Syrian father and son, picked up really, from what I can understand, utterly arbitrarily, and just sitting down there, of course, separated from each other for years in Guantanamo. So as far as change we can believe in, we're not doing too well on this issue of repatriating people from Guantanamo.
No, not doing too well repatriating Guantanamo, closing Guantanamo, or really even changing the paradigm. President Obama bought himself some time, but he hasn't really changed much beyond that. We've seen him in court continue to justify the detention of individuals at Guantanamo. We've seen him...
Let's stay on that for a second, because you mentioned changing the paradigm. And I think that's really, we've mentioned it on the show before, but the new paradigm, so-called new paradigm, that doesn't use the word enemy combatant and the positions in court. Why don't you tell us what that's about?
Well, the old administration's position, advanced by the Department of Justice lawyers under President Bush, said that individuals can be detained as enemy combatants, classified as enemy combatants, properly detained. And when a federal judge said to the Obama administration's Justice Department, you have to give us a revised definition. You have a couple of weeks to process this and tell us what you want us to look at as the Justice Department's new definition of who is detained at Guantanamo and how they can be properly detained. Essentially, what the new Justice Department lawyers did is they removed the terminology enemy combatant, much like the administration has removed the terminology the global war on terror. It is certainly meaningful that the name has been changed, but it is more symbolic than anything else when the underlying definition is virtually identical. There is a definition which includes, to get into a little bit too much detail perhaps, a requirement of substantial support for an organization rather than just support. But other than that, very little has changed. We've seen also in other realms that he has taken the same position, exactly the same position on the continued detention of individuals at Bagram in Afghanistan. We've seen the Obama administration lawyers refuse to step back from the position that the Bush administration had taken on state secrets related to secret CIA prisons. So in terms of the legal definitions, we've seen very, very, very little change. Perhaps there's some attempt to buy some time, but certainly not the kind of change that we were hoping for and expecting.
Emmy, let me ask you this as a human rights attorney and as a political person. How do you explain that? Stepping back, how do you explain this illusion that we see going on?
You know, I have to say, when the Obama administration's new definition of who could be detained at Guantanamo came down, I was with a lot of other people in this super secret secure facility. So we were commiserating with a large group. And
I want to just say what that is, Emmy, the super... your conditions of work is an aside, but it's just important to let people know where you spend your time.
Because virtually all of the information that we work with is classified, because anything that a Guantanamo detainee says is classified until it gets declassified by a privilege team. A lot of that stuff doesn't end up getting declassified. A lot of the documents that we file, certainly a lot of the government allegations and justifications for our clients' detention, ends up staying classified. We have to do our work at a nondescript secret office facility, in a secret location, actually. Certainly there are significant barriers to the way that we work and significant difference in terms of the way that we work and the way that the government attorneys work. The only understanding that I could make for why the Obama definition of why an individual could be detained is virtually identical to the Bush definition of why an individual can be detained is that it is very hard for people in power to give up power. Obama walked into a situation where the Bush lawyers had created a regime that allowed him to detain, allowed him, if he accepted it, to detain a large number of people based largely on executive whim. And as much as he said, you know, during his campaign, I'm a constitutional lawyer. I understand the wrong way that the Bush administration has gone on these issues. Once he stepped into office, I think it was just too difficult to step away from that. I don't know if there's another definition, but that's the best that I could come up with.
Emmy, I want to continue on this theme of what's changed since the executive order. And I know that one of the things that Obama did was send someone down to Guantanamo to see whether it complied with the Geneva Conventions, broadly stated. And they issued some kind of report about that. And I know that, you know, the center has sent a lot of attorneys down to Guantanamo. And I'm interested in whether the conditions have gotten better at Guantanamo, whether that now that particularly they have so many people who even they admit shouldn't be there, whether they're at least giving them a number of privileges, keeping them in better conditions.
One of the other difficulties of doing the work that we do is that it takes a couple of weeks for anything to get cleared. So usually we're a couple of weeks behind in terms of, you know, communicating between counsel about what the conditions are. Certainly in the first month of Obama's term in office, there had been no changes. And after the end of that month, the Obama review team determines that the conditions at Guantanamo complied with the Geneva Conventions, which is certainly not what we were hearing and certainly not what we were seeing. And moreover, our argument was that it was not just the Geneva Conventions that applied at Guantanamo. But the overwhelming majority of the men at Guantanamo were still in really brutal conditions of solitary confinement. We're still reporting severe psychological and very difficult religious abuses at Guantanamo. So certainly what we've heard, the anecdotes that we've heard in the weeks following that is that there have been some efforts to remove some people from solitary confinement and to allow somewhat more communal recreation. But the conditions at Guantanamo remain deeply problematic. And one thing that I found particularly striking from the statement by Admiral Walsh after the review of the conditions at Guantanamo, Admiral Walsh said it was the first time that he had met with detainees at Guantanamo. They met with four or five detainees at Guantanamo. He said one of the things that was striking for him was that solitary confinement, the conditions of detention, and the indefinite nature of the detention actually has a psychological effect on the men, and that he was surprised by that.
Surprised.
There's no reason that he or anyone else within the Department of Defense should be surprised by that. At this point, this is something that they should clearly know, and it's something that they have been saying and we have been saying for a long time, and it's one of the reasons why indefinite detention is completely unacceptable if you're a system in the rule of law.
Emmy, is there any other issue you need to bring us up to date on, or is there anything you can tell people about what to do here? I mean, that aren't lawyers, that aren't in court like you are fighting for Guantanamo detainees?
Well, I'd say in terms of one other issue that's an important issue that people should be aware of is the risk of a continuation of a preventive detention regime. And that's something that we should all be urging Obama to reject completely. Preventive detention is what created Guantanamo. Guantanamo, the whole idea of Guantanamo is that there are people who are too dangerous to release, but who can't be prosecuted or shouldn't be prosecuted. And when President Obama signed the executive order, he said within 1 year, Guantanamo detainees will either be prosecuted, transferred, or put into some undefined third category. The undefined third category is created Guantanamo, and it's something that we cannot accept. Our legal system is tried and tested. And we can't say that the president, whether it's a president that we like or a president that we loathe, can hold people without a trial. So I think that's something that people need to be on the lookout for and make sure that any new regime, that there's no new regime essentially that's created to justify the closure of Guantanamo. People need to either be tried or released, and there is no middle ground.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Emmy. I think that's absolutely crucial. And is there any place people can go to visit if they want to get more active on Guantanamo?
Yeah, I would encourage people to look at our website, ccrjustice.org, and I would also just give a shout-out to the Witness Against Torture people who have been doing an enormous amount of work and have a lot of ways that individual people who are not lawyers can get involved. They've been doing protests in Washington, D.C., including a fast that I have to say was one of the most moving things for any of our clients at Guantanamo. They were deeply touched by the actions of individual citizens in the United States who stood up, who spoke out, who took time off from work, who fasted in solidarity, and they're doing some events as we approach the end of the first 100 days of Obama's term in office. So I'd encourage people to look at their website as well.
And that reminds me, Emmy, of there is still a continuing hunger strike at Guantanamo. Is that right?
There's been long hunger strikes at Guantanamo, people protesting their indefinite detention. You know, one of the more prominent hunger strikers right now is Lakhdar Bamidjan, who is the Bosnian Algerian, who was the named plaintiff in the third case in which the Supreme Court held that Guantanamo detainees have rights to challenge their detention. That case decided in June of last year. He has actually been ordered by a federal judge, a very conservative federal judge, I might add, to be released. That judge said the government should not appeal the case because their evidence was so lacking. Really, the evidence in that case was abominable. After 7 years of detention, he was ordered released, but he remains in Guantanamo today. And so he is on hunger strike, apparently for the first time in his detention, really as a matter of protest for that. But the Yemenis are protesting. The only Yemenis to be released in the last couple of years from Guantanamo was Salim Hamdan, who was someone who had been convicted by military commission and then secured a negotiated release. So a Yemeni who is convicted by military commission is in Yemen, and these Yemenis who have been told that they could be released for years are still in Guantanamo. So there are a lot of injustices that people see, and the limited ability that they have to protest comes from their ability to hunger strike.
Thank you for all your work over the years at Guantanamo, and you know, you're very courageous, and we really appreciate your being on the show.
Emmy, thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.